Chapter 3, Emotional Distance. To me, they were less than animals. Quote, increasing the distance between the combatants, whether by emphasizing their differences or by increasing the chain of responsibility between the aggressor and his victim, allows for an increase in the degree of aggression. Finn Shalit, The Psychology of Conflict and Combat. Cracks in the Veil of Denial. One evening, after giving a presentation on the price and process of killing to a group of veterans in New York, I was asked by a retired World War II veteran who had been in the audience if I could talk with him privately in the bar. After we were alone, he said that there was something he had never told anyone about, something that, after hearing my presentation, he wanted to share with me. He had been an Army officer in the South Pacific, and one night the Japanese launched an infiltration attack on his position. During the attack, a Japanese soldier charged him. I had my .45 caliber pistol in my hand, he said, and the point of his bayonet was no further than you are from me when I shot him. After everything had settled down, I helped search his body, you know, for intelligence purposes, and I found a photograph. Then there was a long pause, and he continued. It was a picture of his wife and these two beautiful children. Ever since, and here tears began to roll down his cheeks, although his voice remained firm and steady, I've been haunted by the thought of these two beautiful children growing up without their father, because I murdered their daddy. I'm not a young man anymore, and soon I'll have to answer to my maker for what I have done. A year later, in a pub in England, I told a Vietnam veteran who was a colonel in the U.S. Army about this incident. As I told him about the photographs, he said, oh no, don't tell me. There was an address on the back of the photo. No, I replied. At least he never mentioned it if there was. Later in the evening, I got back around to asking why he would have thought there was an address on the photos, and he told me that he had had a similar experience in Vietnam, but his photos had addresses on the back of them. And you know, he said, as his eyes lost focus and he slipped into that haunted thousand-yard stare I've seen in so many vets when their minds and emotions return to the battlefield, I've always meant to send those photos back. Each of these men had attained the rank of colonel in the U.S. Army. Both are the distilled essence of all that is good and noble in their generation, and both of them have been haunted by simple photographs. But what these photographs represented was a crack in the veil of denial that makes war possible. The social obstacles to emotional distance. The physical distance process has been addressed previously, but distance in war is not merely physical. There is also an emotional distance process that plays a vital part in overcoming the resistance to killing. Factors such as cultural distance, moral distance, social distance, and mechanical distance are just as effective as physical distance in permitting the killer to deny that he is killing a human being. There was a popular and rather clever saying during the 1960s that asked, what if they gave a war and nobody came? This is not quite as ludicrous a concept as it may seem on the surface. There is a constant danger on the battlefield that, in periods of extended close combat, the combatants will get to know and acknowledge one another as individuals, and subsequently may refuse to kill each other. This danger and the process by which it can occur is poignantly represented by Henry Mendelman's account of his experiences as a German soldier on the Russian front during World War II. There was a lull in the battle during which Mendelman saw two Russians coming out of their foxhole, and I walked over towards them. They introduced themselves and offered me a cigarette, and, as a non-smoker, I thought if they offered me a cigarette, I'll smoke it. But it was horrible stuff. I coughed, and later on, my mate said, you made a horrible impression, standing there with those two Russians and coughing your head off. I talked to them and said it was all right to come closer to the foxhole, because there were three dead Russian soldiers lying there, and I, to my shame, had killed them. They wanted to get the dog tags off them, and the paybooks. I kind of helped them, and we were all bending down, and we found some photos in one of their paybooks, and they showed them to me. We all three stood up and looked at the photos. We shook hands again, and one patted me on my back, and they walked away. Mendelman was called away to drive a half-track back to the field hospital. When he returned to the battlefield over an hour later, he found that the Germans had overrun the Russian position, and although there were some of his friends killed, he found himself to be most concerned about what had happened to those two Russians. Oh, they got killed, they said. I said, how did it happen? Oh, they didn't want to give in. Then we shouted at them, come out with their hands up, and they did not. So one of us went over with the tank, he said, and really got them, and silenced them that way. My feeling was very sad. I had met them on a very human basis, on a comradely basis. They called me comrade, and at that moment, strange as it may seem, I was more sad that they had to die in this mad confrontation than my own mates, and I still think sadly about it. This identification with one's victim is also reflected in the Stockholm Syndrome. Most people know of the Stockholm Syndrome as a process in which the victim of a hostage situation comes to identify with the hostage taker, but it is actually more complex than that and occurs in three stages. First, the victim experiences an increase in association with the hostage taker. Then the victim usually experiences a decrease in identification with the authorities who are dealing with the hostage taker. Finally, the hostage taker experiences an increase in identification and bonding with the victim. One of the more interesting of such cases was the Moluccan train siege in Holland in 1975. In this instance, the terrorists had already shot one hostage and then selected another for execution. This intended victim then asked permission to write a final note to his family, and his request was granted. He was a journalist, and he must have been a very good one, for he wrote such a heart-wrenching letter that, upon reading it, the terrorists took pity on him and shot someone else instead. Sometimes this process can happen on a vast scale. Many times in World War I, there were unofficial suspensions of hostilities that came about through the process of coming to know each other too well. During the Christmas of 1914, British and German soldiers in many sectors met peacefully, exchanged presents, took photographs, and even played soccer. Holmes notes that, in some areas, the truce went on until well into the new year, despite the High Command's insistence that it should be war as usual. Erich Fromm states that there is good clinical evidence for the assumption that destructive aggression occurs, at least to a large degree, in conjunction with a momentary or chronic emotional withdrawal. The situations described above represent a breakdown in the psychological distance that is a key method of removing one's sense of empathy and achieving the emotional withdrawal. Again, some of the mechanisms that facilitate this process include cultural distance, such as racial and ethnic differences, which permit the killer to dehumanize the victim. Moral distance, which takes into consideration the kind of intense belief in moral superiority and vengeful, vigilante actions associated with many civil wars. Social distance, which considers the impact of a lifetime of practice in thinking of a particular class as less than human in a socially stratified environment. Mechanical distance, which includes the sterile Nintendo game unreality of killing through a TV screen, a thermal sight, a sniper sight, or some other kind of mechanical buffer that permits the killer to deny the humanity of his victim. Cultural distance, inferior forms of life. In the section Killing in America, we will examine the methodology a military psychiatrist developed to psychologically enable assassins for the U.S. Navy. This formula primarily involved classical conditioning and systematic desensitization using violent movies, but it also integrated cultural distance processes in order to get the men to think of the potential enemies they will have to face as inferior forms of life, with films biased to present the enemy as less than human. The stupidity of local customs is ridiculed. Local personalities are presented as evil demigods. Quoted in Peter Watson, War on the Mind. The Israeli research mentioned earlier indicates that the risk of death for a kidnapped victim is much greater if the victim is hooded. Cultural distance is a form of emotional hooding that can work just as effectively. Shallet notes that the nearer or more similar the victim of aggression is, the more we can identify with him, and the harder it is to kill him. This process also works the other way around. It is so much easier to kill someone if they look distinctly different from you. If your propaganda machine can convince your soldiers that their opponents are not really human but are inferior forms of life, then their natural resistance to killing their own species will be reduced. Often the enemy's humanity is denied by referring to him as gook, kraut, nip, or raghead. In Vietnam, this process was assisted by the body count mentality, in which we referred to and thought of the enemy as numbers. One Vietnam veteran told me that this permitted him to think that killing the NVA and VC was like stepping on ants. The greatest master of this in recent times may have been Adolf Hitler, with his myth of the Aryan master race, the Übermensch, whose duty it was to cleanse the world of Untermensch. The adolescent soldier against whom such propaganda is directed is desperately trying to rationalize what he is being forced to do, and he is therefore predisposed to believe this nonsense. Once he begins to herd people like cattle, and then to slaughter them like cattle, he very quickly begins to think of them as cattle, or, if you will, Untermensch. According to Trevor Dupuy, the Germans, in all stages of World War II, consistently inflicted 50% more casualties on the Americans and British than were inflicted on them. And the Nazi leadership would probably be the first to tell you that it was this carefully nurtured belief in their racial and cultural superiority that enabled the soldiers to be so successful. But, as we shall see in the section entitled Killing and Atrocities, this enabling also contained an entrapment that contributed greatly to the Nazis' ultimate defeat. But the Nazis are hardly the only ones to wield the sword of racial and ethnic hatred in war. European imperial defeat and domination of the darker races was facilitated by cultural distance factors. However, this can be a double-edged sword. Once oppressors begin to think of their victims as not being the same species, then these victims can accept and use that cultural distance to kill and oppress their colonial masters when they finally gain the upper hand. This double-edged sword was turned on the oppressors when colonial nations rose up in fierce insurrections, such as the Sepoy Mutiny or the Mau Mau Uprising. In the final battles that overthrew imperialism around the world, the backlash of this double-edged sword was a major factor in empowering local populations. The United States is a comparatively egalitarian nation, and therefore has a little more difficulty getting its population to wholeheartedly embrace wartime ethnic and racial hatreds. But in combat against Japan, we had an enemy so different and alien that we were able to effectively implement cultural distance combined with a powerful dose of moral distance since we were avenging Pearl Harbor. Thus, according to Stover's research, 44% of American soldiers in World War II said they would really like to kill a Japanese soldier, but only 6% expressed the same degree of enthusiasm for killing Germans. In Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, cultural distance would have backlashed against us, since our enemy was racially and culturally indistinguishable from our allies. Therefore, we tried hard, at a national policy level, not to emphasize any cultural distance from our enemies. The primary psychological distance factors utilized in Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq was moral distance, deriving from our moral crusade against communism and terrorism. But try as we might, we were not completely successful in keeping the genie of racial hatred in its bottle. Most of the Vietnam veterans I've interviewed developed a profound love for the Vietnamese culture and people. Many married Vietnamese women. This egalitarian tendency to mingle with and accept, admire, and even love another culture is an American strong point. Because of it, America was able to turn occupied Germany and Japan from defeated enemies to friends and allies. But many U.S. soldiers in Vietnam spent their year in country isolated from the positive, friendly aspects of Vietnamese culture and people. The only Vietnamese they met were either trying to kill them or were suspected of being or supporting Viet Cong. This environment had the capacity to develop profound suspicion and hatred. One Vietnam veteran told me that, to him, they were less than animals. Because of this ability to accept other cultures, Americans probably committed fewer atrocities than most other nations would have under the circumstances associated with guerrilla warfare in Vietnam, certainly fewer than was the track record among most colonial powers. Yet still we had our My Lai, and our efforts in that war were profoundly, perhaps fatally, undermined by that single incident. And in Iraq, the photographs of abusive behavior by U.S. soldiers and the Abu Ghraib prison scandal helped to inflame our enemies and undermine our own determination. It can be easy to unleash this genie of racial and ethnic hatred in order to facilitate killing in time of war. But once the genie is out and the war is over, it is not easily put back in the bottle. Such hatred lingers over the decades, even centuries, as can be seen in Lebanon and what was once Yugoslavia. It would be easy to feel some smug, self-righteous sense of superiority and convince ourselves that such lingering hatreds exists only in distant insular nations like Lebanon or Yugoslavia. The truth is that we are still trying to suppress racism more than a century after the end of slavery, and our limited use of cultural distance in World War II and Vietnam still tarnishes our dealings with our opponents in those wars. On some future battlefield, we may be tempted to once again manipulate this two-edged sword of cultural distance to our advantage. but before doing so, we would be well advised to carefully consider the costs. The costs both during the war and in the peace that we hope to have attained when the war is over. Moral distance. Their cause is holy, so how can they sin? We who strike the enemy where his heart beats have been slandered as baby killers and murderers of women. What we do is repugnant to us too, but necessary, very necessary. Nowadays, there is no such animal as a non-combatant. Modern warfare is total warfare. A soldier cannot function at the front without the factory worker, the farmer, and all the other providers behind him. You and I, Mother, have discussed this subject, and I know you understand what I say. My men are brave and honorable. Their cause is holy, so how can they sin while doing their duty? If what we do is frightful, then may frightfulness be Germany's salvation. Captain Peter Strasser, head of Germany's World War I Airship Division, which conducted early strategic bombing missions, in a letter quoted in Gwyn Dyer's book, War. Moral distance involves legitimizing oneself and one's cause. It can generally be divided into two components. The first component usually is the determination and condemnation of the enemy's guilt, which, of course, must be punished or avenged. The other is an affirmation of the legality and legitimacy of one's own cause. Moral distance establishes that the enemy's cause is clearly wrong, his leaders are criminal, and his soldiers are either simply misguided or are sharing in their leader's guilt. But the enemy is still a human, and killing him is an act of justice rather than the extermination that is often motivated by cultural distance. In the same way that this process has traditionally enabled violence in police forces, it can also enable violence on the battlefield. Alfred Vocht recognized this as a process in which enemies are to be determined criminals in advance, guilty of starting the war. The business of locating the aggressor is to begin before or shortly after the outbreak of war. The enemy's methods of conducting the war are to be branded as criminal, and victory is not to be a triumph of honor and bravery over honor and bravery, but the climax of a police hunt for bloodthirsty wretches who have violated law, order, and everything else esteemed good and holy. Vocht felt that this kind of propaganda has had an increasing influence on modern war, and he may well be right. And, indeed, it could arguably have a legitimate place, as in U.S. and coalition operations against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Iraq. But this is really nothing new. In the West, it dates back at least to those days when the Pope, then the undisputed moral leader of Western civilization, established the moral justification for the tragic and bloody wars we call the Crusades. Punishment justification. Remember the Alamo, Maine, Pearl Harbor, 9/11. The establishment of the enemy's guilt and the need to punish or avenge is a fundamental and widely accepted justification for violence. Most nations reserve the right to administer capital punishment, and if a state directs a soldier to kill a criminal who is guilty of a sufficiently heinous crime, then the killing can be readily rationalized as nothing more than the administration of justice. The mechanism of punishment justification is so fundamental that it can sometimes be artificially manipulated. In World War II, some Japanese leaders cultivated an artificial punishment justification. Colonel Masanobu Tsuji, says Holmes, who masterminded Japanese planning for the invasion of Malaya, wrote a tract designed, among other things, to screw his soldiers to a pitch of fighting fury. When you encounter the enemy after landing, think of yourself as an avenger come at last face to face with your father's murderer. Here is a man whose death will lighten your heart of its burden of brooding anger. If you fail to destroy him utterly, you can never rest in peace. Legal affirmation. We hold these truths to be self-evident. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Declaration of Independence. The affirmation of the legality of one's own case is the flip side of punishment motivation. This process of asserting the legitimacy of your cause is one of the primary mechanisms enabling violence in civil wars, since the similarities of the combatants make it difficult to develop cultural distance. but moral distance is, in varying degrees, also a violence-enabling factor in all wars, not just civil wars. One of the major manifestations of moral distance is what might be called the home court advantage. The moral advantage associated with defending one's own den, home, or nation has a long tradition that can be found in the animal kingdom as well, and it should not be neglected in assessing the impact of moral distance in empowering a nation's violence. Winston Churchill said that it is the primary right of men to die and kill for the land they live in, and to punish with exceptional severity all members of their own race who have warmed their hands at the invader's hearth. American wars have usually been characterized by a tendency towards moral rather than cultural distance. Cultural distance has been a little harder to develop in America's comparatively egalitarian culture, with its ethnically and racially diverse population. In the American Revolution, the Boston Massacre provided a degree of punishment justification, and the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, represented the legal affirmation that set the tone for America's wars for the next two centuries. The War of 1812 was waged in self-defense, with the home court advantage very much on our side. And the burning of the White House and the bombardment of Fort McHenry, oh say can you see, by the dawn's early light, serving as rallying points for punishment justification, the moral foundations of our legal affirmation for our nation's concern for the oppression of others can be seen in the Civil War, and the very sincere motivation on the part of many Northern soldiers to end slavery. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. While a degree of punishment motivation can be seen in the bombardment of Fort Sumter. In the last 100 years, we have moved slightly away from moral affirmation as a justification for starting wars, and have focused more on the punishment aspects of moral distance. In the Spanish-American War, it was the sinking of the Maine that provided the punishment justification for war. In World War I, it was the sinking of the Lusitania. In World War II, it was Pearl Harbor. In Korea, it was an unprovoked attack on American troops. In Vietnam, it was the Gulf of Tonkin incident. In the Gulf War, it was the invasion of Kuwait. And in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was 9/11 and the possibility of weapons of mass destruction. It is interesting to note that although punishment was used to justify starting America's involvement of these wars, moral affirmation came into play later and lent a very American flavor to some of these conflicts. Once the Allies began to liberate concentration camps, General Eisenhower began to view World War II as a crusade, and the justification for the Cold War and the global war on terror had consistent underpinnings as a moral battle against totalitarianism, oppression, and terrorism. Moral distance processes tend to provide a foundation upon which other killing-enabling processes can be built. In general, they are less likely to produce atrocities than cultural distance processes, and they are more in keeping with the kind of rules, deterring aggression, and upholding individual human dignity, that organizations such as the United Nations have attempted to uphold. But as with cultural distance, there is a danger associated with moral distance. The danger is, of course, that every nation seems to think that God is on its side. Social distance. Death across the swine log. While working as a sergeant in the 82nd Airborne Division in the 1970s, I once visited a sister battalion's operations office. Most such offices have a large in-out roster as you come in the door. Usually these rosters have a list of all the people in the office, organized by rank. But this one had a different twist. On top of the list were the officers. Then there was a divider section labeled swine log. And then there was a list of all the enlisted personnel in the office. This concept of the swine log was a fairly common one. And although it was usually used in good humor, and usually more subtly, there is a social distance between officers and enlisted personnel. I've been a private, a sergeant, and an officer. My wife, my children, and I have all experienced this class structure and the social distance that goes with it. Officers, non-commissioned officers, and enlisted members all have separate clubs on a military base. Their wives often go to separate social functions. Their families usually live in separate housing areas. To understand the role of the swine log in the military, we must understand how hard it is to be the one to give the orders that will send your friends to their deaths, and how easy is the alternative of surrendering honorably and ending the horror. The essence of the military is that to be a good leader, you must truly love, in a strangely detached fashion, your men. And then you must be willing to kill, or at least give the orders that will result in the deaths of, that which you love. The paradox of war is that those leaders who are most willing to endanger that which they love can be the ones who are most liable to win, and therefore most likely to protect their men. The social class structure that exists in the military provides a denial mechanism that makes it possible for leaders to order their men to their deaths, but it makes military leadership a very lonely thing. This class structure is even more pronounced in the British Army. During my year at the British Staff College, the British officers who were my friends felt very strongly, and I agree with them, that their lifetime of experience in the British class system made them better officers. The influence of social distance must have been very powerful in ages past, when all officers came from the nobility and had a lifetime's experience in wielding the power of life and death. In nearly all historical battles prior to the age of Napoleon, the serf who looked down his spear or musket at the enemy saw another hapless serf, very much like himself, and we can understand that he was not particularly inclined to kill his mirror image. And so it is that the great majority of close combat killing in ancient history was not done by the mobs of serfs and peasants who formed a great mass of combatants. It was the elite, the nobility, who were the real killers in these battles, usually in the pursuit phase after the battle on horseback or from chariots. And they were enabled by, among other things, social distance. Mechanical distance. I don't see people. Quote, "The development of new weapon systems enables the soldier, even on the battlefield, to fire more lethal weapons more accurately to longer ranges. His enemy is increasingly an anonymous figure encircled by a gun sight, glowing on a thermal imager, or shrouded in armor plate." Richard Holmes, Acts of War. Social distance is generally fading as a form of killing enabling in Western war, but even as it disappears in this more egalitarian age, it is being replaced by a new technologically based form of psychological distance. During the Gulf War, this was referred to as Nintendo warfare, which evolved into video game combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. The infantry kills the enemy up close and personal, but in recent decades the nature of this close-in battle has changed significantly. Until the 1980s, in the U.S. Army, the night sight was a rare and exotic piece of equipment. Now we fight primarily at night, and there is a thermal imagery device or a night vision device for almost every combat soldier. Thermal imagery sees the heat emitted by a body as if it were light. Thus, it works to see through rain, fog, and smoke. It permits you to perceive through camouflage, and it makes it possible to detect enemy soldiers deep in woodlines and vegetation that would once have completely concealed them. Night vision devices provide a superb form of psychological distance by converting the target into an inhuman green blob. The complete integration of thermal imagery technology into the modern battlefield has extended to daylight hours the mechanical distance process that currently exists during the night. Now, in many cases, the battlefield appears to every soldier as it did to Gad, an Israeli tank gunner, who told Holmes that, "You see it all as if it were happening on a TV screen. It occurred to me at the time, I see someone running, and I shoot at him, and he falls. And it all looks like something on TV. I don't see people. That's one good thing about it."